Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk the Arts. I am your host, Rachel Sara, and today I am so excited to have this guest in the studio. We have Steph Parkin, the deadly, incredible lawyer who has helped many people, including myself. And today we're going to be talking about copyright and intellectual property. Steph, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Happy to be here at AAA. Thanks for having me.
Deadly. Tell us a little bit about yourself, who your mob is and where you grew up.
Yes. So I come from the Kornamooka people of North Stradbroke Island and the surrounding Moreton Bay areas. So we're saltwater people over there. All my family continue to live over there on the island. I'm the only one now living here on the mainland in Brisbane. But it's a really lovely thing because I'm able to get home when I can, still living so close to home. So that's really special to be able to continue to go back when I can. And spend that time. We're connected to a lot of family groups over on the island, and I come down from the Delaney and Martin family lines. So that's a little bit about me. Deadly. And where I'm from.
I'm sure people already have a good understanding of who you are. You've been around Brizzy and Meanjin for a while doing your thing.
Yes, that's right. So I've been down here living in Brisbane for a while. So I actually did my primary school up in Moranbah in central Queensland. So
wow.
At that time, Dad had a job up there in the mines. So the family were living up there for quite some time. And then in high school, we decided to come back down here to Brisbane. And of course, for Mum to be closer to family and back on country. As well, so that was really important. And then doing high school and then university down here in Brisbane. So yeah, definitely been around the area for a while now, and yeah, it's been a good journey to date to now have my own law firm and practicing my own law firm, Parallax Legal, with my business partner Cassie Lang.
Yeah,
she's a Bundjalung woman, and she's a Native Title and Cultural Heritage lawyer. So we've joined forces just over 12 months ago now to start the business. So it's an exciting time, definitely.
Well, in that short time, I'm sure you've become everyone's most important person in their life. Definitely, I can say that about you for my business. But so specifically, you are an intellectual and copyright lawyer, is that right?
Yeah, so I describe myself as an intellectual property lawyer, and I think that's the thing with all lawyers, like there's definitely specialties that everyone has, and so that's really the specialty that I have. So advising a whole range of different clients in relation to contracts that they might enter into, particularly relating to intellectual property, but you know, it also might be in other general commercial aspects as well that clients might need advice on. So intellectual property is the specific area, but it applies through a whole range of different industries, which I really think, gives the area, it means the work that I do is exciting because it's not just, while I do have a particular focus, I suppose, in the creative space, IP and Indigenous cultural intellectual property becomes really important at that scale as well. So, that's the area of law that I've practiced in.
Yeah, deadly. And so for those who may not know, obviously we are on Let's Talk the Arts. So we're specifically diving into how it relates to artists and creatives and creative businesses. But for those who may not know or recognize what intellectual property is, and copyright for that matter, could you give us a brief kind of elevator pitch of what those two are?
Yeah, so I like to think of intellectual property, it's like an umbrella type of term. So it's the general... yes, it's the umbrella type of term. Intellectual property is the property that's created out of the intellect or the mind of someone. And then you have different types of intellectual properties. They're recognised globally, not just here in Australia. So they're pretty generic, general terms.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's important to know also is that these terms are based on Western concepts of understanding and approaches to property as well. And we know from the work that we do and, you know, obviously the work of yourself, Rachel, as a creative, that these laws don't always address the needs of our people
mm-hmm.
in a whole range of different aspects, but particularly in the creative space.
Yeah. And so if we speak specifically for non-Indigenous artists to begin with, or really anyone, I guess, why is it important for artists to understand what that is, intellectual property and copyright?
I think it's important because intellectual property and copyright of an artist, it's like an asset to them. Mm. So it's something that you have as an artist that you've created, and having copyright and rights over your work mean that you own the work, you have the exclusive right to use the work, you can allow others to share in your work, and you can also get paid for your work. So I really like to send the message to artists that the work that you create is really valuable.
Absolutely.
It's really valuable to you as an artist from a cultural point of view, but also from a business and financial point of view.
Mm.
And so if you do have people or organisations that are approaching you who want to engage with you and work with you, you can really ensure that the work that you're creating is also, you know, returning financial benefits to you as well. So yeah. When we do talk about the importance of it, it's important from a financial and business point of view, but also from a cultural point of view as well. So there's always different ways of looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, when I reflect on my own journey, I would say I'm quite confident in knowing what my rights are and knowing how to stand up for myself and be paid or ask to be paid. But a lot of young mob really struggle with that. So a lot of the work you do as well is kind of providing that contractual agreement and that, I guess, security for young mob. Is that something that you're seeing have like a huge increase recently with, I guess, us having a few gaps that we need to kind of secure a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think more and more, I think artists across the board are, you know, becoming more aware of their rights. And I think that's the first thing for artists to understand, that you do have rights.
Mm.
And as an artist, what you bring to the table in any engagement is really valuable. And there is an increasing awareness, I think, of the importance of contracts in entering into these things when someone wishes to use your work. Totally get it. It can be a really daunting experience as artists, and, you know, having to negotiate contracts, you know, wanting to change clauses to make sure that they're favourable to you.
Mm.
And I think the message really is that artists and creatives across the board, you do have the right to negotiate.
Mm.
You know, you don't always have to accept the terms of a contract that are provided to you.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, to not shy away from that. And I suppose, you know, you get better at these things
yeah.
the more you do it. But for artists to have the confidence to know, actually, you can negotiate, you can ask for more money, you can change the terms of an agreement as well. So I think when you think about engagements in that way, artists are in a really powerful position.
Mm.
And to feel confident in that.
Yeah.
So that's also a part of the work that we do as well. Yes, we assist with the legal application of contracts and intellectual property and copyright, but also the other aspects, the non-legal aspects, you know, making sure that artists do have a full understanding of what they're getting into. Mm. And that's not only a good thing for artists, as you know, in the work that you do, Rachel, making sure that you've got all of the information in front of you to be able to make an informed decision as to whether or not this is actually something you want to go ahead with.
Yeah.
And also, not only from the legal point of view, but who are these other organisations that you're partnering with? You know, how is that going to reflect on your reputation as an artist as well? So there's all these other commercial aspects that become really important. And I think just knowing that artists, you know, you're strong and you've got a really valuable resource that people want to engage with. And if people are willing to engage with you, then they should be willing to negotiate as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did kind of talk a big game saying I was super confident in advocating for myself. But I'll admit as well, there's been a number of phone calls and conversations I've had with you just to be like, what the hell is going on with this? And I think that's something that a lot of people really navigate. But I think what we're seeing here, or not that I think, I know and we're experiencing, but there is a disconnect between a colonial legal system and that cultural legal system.
Mm.
And what might be acceptable in a Western kind of relationship between, I guess, an artist and an organization or a business, there are some things that culturally don't align. And are there ways artists can protect themselves in, as an example, if there was sacred site destructions or something and you're engaged in a contract, is there a way that, or is there a gap that needs to be filled for artists to have that cultural safety as well as a legal safety?
Mm. Yeah, definitely agree with you. There are gaps that exist. And I think fundamentally we're dealing with the colonial system. When I'm dealing with intellectual property laws and contracts, yes, all of these terms are based on, you know, Western concepts and understandings of what is valuable. And take copyright, for example. So it's based on this notion that you have exclusive use over something for a certain period of time. And then once copyright protection ends, it goes into the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole premise behind it is about encouraging innovation and economic benefits for copyright owners. That's the whole basis of it, really. To be able to support innovation for a certain period of time, and then that material then goes into the public domain once copyright protection is no longer in force. And so even those concepts themselves, exclusivity,
public domain,
all of those things are so in contrast to how mob like to deal with materials, cultural information, cultural expression, the way that we understand the importance of looking after things in a certain way. For example, you know, a lot of our materials are collectively owned. That goes against the premise of copyright, which is recognised as being individually or joint ownership. You know, we know that a lot of our materials and cultural expressions exist, you know, forever. Mm. They've always existed, you know, since millennia and as far forward as we can possibly think.
Mm.
Well, then that doesn't align with the copyright protection of 70 years after you pass away, and then it goes into the public domain. The whole idea about the public domain being a free-for-all, meaning anyone can use it for anything. And again, we contrast that with, you know, cultural materials that we might have, where there's particular protocols around how those materials are used. Only certain people can access it, can't be used for purposes of X, Y, Z. So there's certainly tension that exists between the existing intellectual property laws and how our people and communities like to protect and maintain our own cultural integrity over these same materials. So one of the things I think that is heading in the right direction is that there's been a recent announcement by the federal government to have a commitment to standalone laws, so standalone Indigenous cultural and intellectual property laws. So those types of laws have been spoken about for a very long time, for decades. Artists, people in the industry have been talking about the need for standalone legislation, because things like copyright, trademarks and everything else were never really designed in the first place to protect mobs' rights. And it's like, you know, square peg, round hole. This is what we've been trying to do this whole time, trying to use these existing laws to sort of manoeuvre around and use them to the possible extent that we can. But in the end, they're still not really designed to address our rights. So there is some commitment there for standalone legislation. Something like that, though, could take years to formulate. And my understanding is that it just won't be in relation to the arts or the creative space. It'll be ICIP more broadly. And so until that actually occurs, those gaps that you talked about, Rachel, still continue to exist. And it means that while those gaps exist and while this legislation's being developed, it means that all the agreements that artists enter into and protocols become really important in trying to address those gaps.
So everything you're saying is so wild to me. Like, I've engaged you for some time, so I understand a lot of what you are speaking about, but then you're also still just spitting gems of vulnerability for us, Mob, aren't you?
Yes.
But I want to take it in a very public, I guess, example of this. And I think a prominent copyright example was the Aboriginal flag. Is there, what do you interpret that? Because I'm thinking even the 70 years after someone passes, it goes to public domain. I guess in some senses that is already now in a public domain.
Yes. Well, the flag has had a really, it's had a long journey, I think, to get where it's gotten to right now. So even understanding who created the flag initially, you know, there's obviously been differing views around that as well. And there were some early decisions made to determine who owns the copyright in the work. And out of that decision early on in the 90s, if I recall correctly, that a decision was made that Harold Thomas was the copyright owner of the flag. And so there had been, because of that, because as a copyright owner, he had certain rights to exercise over the flag. And that also included the ability for him as the copyright owner to enter into license agreements, even exclusive license agreements with third parties to be able to commercialize and reproduce the flag in certain ways. I think the tension there that also existed, which is what we saw from community across the board, was the tension between the individual rights of a copyright owner versus the community expectation as to how the flag should be used or not used or, you know, sold or to be made money off. So, again, when we're talking about the tensions that exist, that definitely was one.
Yeah.
And there was an inquiry that looked at the status of the flag and what some of the options would be to try and rectify the situation, particularly from a community point of view. And then ultimately what ended up happening is that there was a negotiation between the federal government and the artist, Harold Thomas, and that meant that, you know, compensation was paid to buy the copyright.
Yeah.
In that work. So it's an unusual situation that has occurred. It's been a long journey. Many things have happened with the flag, but that's ultimately where it's ended up.
I think it's such an important case study that actually critiques those gaps and especially what you mentioned, the community expectations of certain shared, I guess, intellectual property and copyright. But I want to, I guess, divert the conversation a little bit around cultural appropriation and intellectual property and copyright law. So we are seeing big political and social conversations around this. And what I'm seeing is there is a wave of people who are using Aboriginal art as inspiration, non-Indigenous people using Aboriginal art as inspiration, and going even deeper to the fake art industry that exists that is profiting off of our culture. Is there, I guess, when critiquing that as an as a prime example of a lack of, is there anything we can do as artists? And does intellectual property and cultural, I guess, copyright, is that included in this space?
I agree with you. There's a lot of really interesting, you know, challenges and conversations being had around this idea of appropriation. So in terms of how the current sort of legal landscape can address the issue, so if your work is being copied, like a direct copy, or it's been substantially copied by somebody else, there's obviously some protections under the Copyright Act, mm-hmm. so for copyright infringement. But again, and this is where some of that grey area of, you know, inspired by works occur. It's not necessarily a direct copy, but it's in the same style of. And currently here, there's no protection of certain styles of artwork. So, you know, for us and for, I suppose, the broader public, they associate, the dot painting style with a lot of Aboriginal artists, or the rark style. So there's no actual protection of styles. But if someone is directly copying or has a substantial copy of your work, there might be some aspects that you can rely upon in the Copyright Act to claim infringement. That then again also opens up a whole aspect and avenue of, you know, sending letters of demand, you know, making claims of infringement. And that can be a long, drawn out process as well. When we talk about, you know, the issues of fake art, well, fake art, when we talk about it in terms of the souvenir market, we're talking about products that have been made overseas without the involvement of any Aboriginal person. They've been imported here in Australia and then sold, mass produced across the country. And so these are products that have the look and feel of being made by mob, but they haven't been made by mob at all from beginning to end. And that's really problematic. So there's no laws that stop that in Australia currently. The best law that we've been able to sort of look at is consumer law, which deals with how products are sort of labelled and sold in the market. So if a product is made like that from overseas, there are some arguments that someone could be misled as to the characteristics or the origin of it. Like a tourist might look at that and think, oh, just by looking at that, I'm assuming that it's been made by an Aboriginal
Deadly
person.
Deadly Aunt Karen just did it.
but they obviously haven't. So there was a case also around that few years ago. The ACCC took action against Berube Art that the listeners might be aware of.
Yeah.
It still, though, fell short because there were some aspects that breached the laws, but there were some that weren't. But obviously the whole existence of that type of product is so, like, culturally offensive to mobs across the country, and have been really strong in speaking out against that. So the way that that product is allowed to exist, made overseas, imported, if you put a sticker on it that says made in Indonesia or made in China, the law currently says, well, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that, because consumers are not misled. They know that it's come from overseas and not here. Well, we say that's still terribly offensive. And it really shouldn't have any place here, because not only from a legal perspective and and also the cultural harms that are inflicted upon, you know, creative and cultural practitioners, it speaks a lot, I think, to also our identity as, you know, people who are living in this country. Like, what does it say when we allow this type of product to exist?
Yeah.
It says a lot.
Yeah. So what you're saying is we collectively as mob couldn't just start a class action and take down everyone in Indonesia.
Well, I'm not saying that we can't, but what I am saying, I think the interesting thing there, though, is that all those products, they were imported by Australian, non-Indigenous Australian businesses.
Yeah.
So the mob over in, you know, Indonesia and China, they're also getting exploited too.
Yeah.
Because of how they're having to create those works.
Yeah.
The problem is the non-Indigenous Australian businesses who operate here and have allowed that to occur.
Yeah. Now we are running out of time, and I suspect that you might get an invitation to Let's Talk Business with Jai after this. But just to summarize, there's a lot of young artists out there navigating this world. I'm very grateful for you. We had Keisha on a few weeks ago and we shouted you out as influential and so important in our practices. Is there any advice that you could give young people looking to continue to build their hobby into a career and how they can protect themselves?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting that we've got so many of our young people coming up through the ranks now. And it's really, it's inspiring for me. I think it's inspiring for all of us, really.
Mm.
And people like yourself, Rachel, you know, in the work that you do as well. And so it's really great to see. And I suppose there's two sort of aspects to it. You know, for artists to be confident in the works that they're producing, to have integrity in the works, you know that it comes from somewhere. Know that the works artists and creatives are producing come from, you know, the knowledge that has been passed down over thousands of generations, and to be confident in that.
Mm.
Know that where that comes from a really powerful place. And so I think for artists across the board, understanding and, you know, knowing where you come from and being connected to where you come from as well, that gives you power and authority in the work that you're producing. So there's that integrity aspect to it, I think, is one part. And that informs the value of the work. And then also equally is the legal aspects that I'd really encourage young artists to, you know, get ahead of, get on the front foot of, to know that you've got rights that you can negotiate, as I said before, to not shy away from that, to know that you do have value, that you can negotiate, and to not be afraid of that at all, because ultimately what you're producing is cultural material that's really important for all of us, and maintaining that is really important. So, and to know that you there are services that you can access. So there's like organisations like the Arts Law Centre of Australia. They give free legal advice to mob as well. You can come and talk to people like myself, and there's other organisations that are out there to support artists. So, yeah, to know that you've got rights and you can negotiate.
Mm. And on that note, speaking of places they can reach out, where can we find or engage with you?
Well, we are on social media, Parallax Legal. We've got Instagram and LinkedIn.
Well, I personally can say you are worth your weight in absolute gold. I'm so grateful to have you in my corner and to just give me that added understanding our rights. I think that's so important. Thanks, sis.